It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. WESA's content partner, Public Source, has been running a series of articles on drug use and overdoses in Pennsylvania. The latest story explores the stigma professionals in the workplace face when confronting addiction. Joining us in studio to discuss the issue are Public Source reporter Jeffrey Benzing and Jason Snyder, Executive Director of the Consumer Health Coalition. Jeffrey Benzing, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me on.
And Jason Snyder, thank you for coming in to share your story with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
And I see that you have my same nervous habit of clicking the pen, so don't make me take that away
from you. That's right. Sorry about that.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Jason Snyder, after years of opiate abuse, you were lying to everyone around you about your addiction, even after watching your younger brothers, Todd and Josh, die from their drug problems. Why didn't the deaths of your brothers get you to stop?
I think probably primarily I did not think that my problem was as significant as theirs. And at the time, it may not have been. I was on a path that was getting progressively worse, but at the time, I didn't see myself as being as quote-unquote bad as them. And therein, I think, lies a big issue that we have to deal with today, Paul, and that is the stigma. I had a hard time then even believing that I could be on the path to addiction. I did not look like what we stereotypically see portrayed as a person with the disease of addiction. So that in and of itself, I think, played a role in my denial that I was on a path of destruction.
And let's talk about that contrast a little bit. The down and out, I guess the typical stereotypical view that we have of an addict, particularly someone who is addicted to something hard like heroin, is skid row appearance, out on the street, not very well kept. And in your case, you were a successful businessman at a public relations firm, making a good living with a wife and family, and there was nothing outwardly obvious about your being an addict. That's what you're talking about here, and I'm guessing that that is part of what makes it difficult for someone like you to confront.
Yeah, exactly. So the way I have come to look at it, and the way I think we need to look at this going forward if we are to begin to address stigma and begin to stem the tide of the drug overdose deaths that we are currently in, is how I got to addiction compared with how others got there, what others might have done as part of their act of addiction, what I've done. Those things really shouldn't be what we're focusing on. Instead, we should be thinking about how do we get that person out of active addiction and into recovery. So really the paths that all people with addiction take, they're a little different. You know, my story is different than the millions of others who are actively addicted today, but we really have two similarities. Either we are people with the disease of addiction or we are people in recovery from the disease of addiction. So that is in big part why I chose to tell my story. Certainly, the stigma that professionals face is a big barrier to accessing treatment for many of the reasons that Jeff outlined in his piece. We're afraid that the image we've built, the lives we've built, will be dismantled. But the stigma also prevents us from accepting, I think, that we are people with addiction because we don't look like those stereotypical people you described, Paul. So again, the reason why I chose to come out and tell my story and talk about my family's story is because I really don't look at myself differently than I do my brothers, for example. We, all three of us, were people with the disease of addiction. Fortunately, I found recovery and my brothers didn't. So that's how I think we need to look at this today.
Is it unusual to have all three kids in one family become drug addicts?
I would say...
And I'm not talking about, three brothers who occasionally use marijuana.
Sure.
Or even use it on a regular basis. We're talking, you know, heroin or opiates here.
Sure. I can tell you this, in my experience, when I tell people who aren't intimately familiar with addiction and recovery that I lost my only two siblings to drug overdose deaths, I can almost see their jaws hit the floor. But in my experience, spending time with others in recovery, it's not all that unique. Two brothers, maybe somewhat, but to lose siblings, to lose parents, it happens quite regularly. So to the outside world, it is very shocking, and it was shocking to me at the time. At the time, you never think this is going to happen. You hold on to some hope that somehow this is going to reverse course. And so when my first brother died from a drug overdose, we were devastated, but there was some part of us that knew this was a possibility. 2.5 years later, when my other brother Josh dies, it is unthinkable. So to answer your question, it's not totally out of the question or unique that multiple siblings, I think, die from this disease, based on my experience being with others in recovery.
And here you were it was a known fact in your family that at least one of your brothers, if not both of them, were struggling, and that something horrible happening to them, which ended up happening, they both died. That was always a possibility in your mind and certainly in your parents' mind. They were thinking, and this is according to Jeffrey's story, the way he described it, they were looking at you as the one guy who had his act together. What was it like when you, and you, of course, for this reason and others, wanted to hide your addiction from them. What was it like for you when you finally had to confront them, to tell your parents, hey, in spite of what you think of me, I've got a problem?
Well, there were a lot of feelings, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. But I'll also say that when I finally told them, and I told the others who most mattered in my life at the time, that this is who I am and what I'm dealing with, it was a big burden relieved. There was still a long way to go, but living a lie after lie was—it's very tiring. It's a daily fight, a daily struggle. So, telling my parents, it was an anxious time because they did have me on a pedestal, and I think they still do. But it was a fearful time. It was an anxious time, but it was some relief in it as well.
Jeffrey Benzing, a public source. Why is it difficult for professionals to seek treatment? What did you find as you told Jason's story and looked at the situations of others?
Sure. So in my reporting, I was reaching out. You know, I was looking, of course, at Jason's story, but trying to see how broadly that can relate to others. And Jason was working in PR. I talked with folks who work in the legal profession, medical profession. And to, you know, sort of see these are people who are portrayed as being very successful, have their lives together, have a pretty nice life. And the struggle then is to sort of admit that you have a failing. Like, for instance, if you're a lawyer, You're the one that you're used to having people come to you to solve their problems, and you're the one in charge. You're sort of driving the bus, and you sort of get way down the line. You realize that you have a huge problem with pills or with cocaine or with heroin, hard substances that really sort of end up taking control of you. You think you're in control, and it's a matter of sort of overcoming that fear that people are going to judge you differently and that it's going to actually have a consequence on your career, not for having a problem, but for getting help for it and for identifying yourself as somebody that has the disease of addiction. And there are resources out there, which I get into in my story, through professional groups, through employee assistance programs, which a lot of companies have, where the employer will pay for relatively small, but a certain number of sessions to get you in front of a counselor who can diagnose, sort of get you toward treatment. And these are things that can make it a lot less stressful to sort of navigate the stigma and the fears that you have, having someone who kind of has your back.
Was this the case for actor Philip Seymour Hoffman? He has tragically become the poster child for the person that you think has it all, you know, has the has the Oscars and the money and all these opportunities to do things that people are would love to do, and drugs short-circuited his life, shortened his life, and he couldn't break free, and people are still wondering why. Maybe this is
right. I mean,
part of it.
What we know is that addiction does not discriminate at all. Doesn't mean if you're the richest man in the world, if you're poor on Skid Row.
But I guess the question I'm asking is the higher the pedestal you're on, does that create more difficulty for you to admit you have a problem and to open your life up to others?
Sure, it certainly can. I mean, it's hard for everyone, I'm sure. But when you have a lot to lose, you know that. And that's, I think Jason would probably say as well. I mean, that's something that is at sort of the front of your mind. How do you reconcile the two lives you've built, the one that's very successful and has all these nice things, and the one that you sort of feel you're out of control and crumbling?
We're talking about a new public source story just out, One Professional's Fight with Stigma, Denial, and Opioid Painkillers, written by Jeffrey Benzing, and it frames the life of Jason Snyder, who has battled addiction and who has opened up his story so that others can perhaps benefit from what he has gone through. He is featured in this story, a compelling story by Jeffrey Benzing. If you have a comment or question for either of our guests, 412-246-2002 is the number to call again, 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. I want to get back to Jason's story. But, Jeff, did Jason's parents have concerns when talking with you about their son's struggles with addiction? You're reporting on a very personal family matter here.
It was certainly something that I could tell from talking with them that was difficult for them to get into. You know, these are the deaths of two of their sons. Very dark days and hard things to want to discuss at all, much less for something that's going to go out on the internet to the public. I found them very open, though, and willing to talk about not just the bad times, but sort of the hope that they see in Jason and see where he's come from in the 3.5 years since he drove home to them and admitted that he had the same problem that killed their two other sons. And I think, though, it's something that if you look at broadly, it's a difficult thing for any family. I mean, go home to your mom and say, hey, what you think of me is not quite right. I know that I would have trouble, certainly in this circumstance, admitting something like that.
And we all
do, right? And just, you know, if it's something that has that emotional pain attached to it, it's, a very heavy burden.
And Jason, you comment in Jeff's piece about your upbringing and what great what a great childhood you had, how involved your parents were. So even a great childhood and loving parents can't necessarily prevent this.
That's for sure. And that's a big reason why I wanted to stress that. My parents are still married today, and they provided everything that we needed. My dad was a hardworking blue-collar guy for much of his career. My mother stayed home and raised three kids. She was involved in the PTA, as Jeff pointed out in the story. My dad was a longtime Little League coach. My parents were very involved in our lives. They made sure, my mother especially, that my homework was done, that I was studying for tests, all of those things. And so we did not come from a broken home. We did not come from an abusive home. We had everything we needed and many times everything we wanted. My dad and mother found ways to provide those. So nothing off kilter about our upbringing whatsoever.
You explain in the story that drug users tend to find things lacking in so-called normal life. What are they? Why do these voids exist? Why did they exist for you?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and I wish I had a good answer to it, Paul, because then maybe we could begin to put into place some true prevention kind of work. But as I've come to learn based on my experiences with recovery, addiction is much more than the obsessive compulsive use of drugs. It's really a spiritual, if you will, kind of disease as well. In my experience, nothing ever really satisfied me, if you will. It always felt like there was some kind of hole, something missing. I had to have something different or something more. And eventually I found it in drugs and alcohol. And so a big part of my recovery and the hope and the peace that I've found over the last couple of years is really taking a close look at that and trying to answer the very question that you ask. And so it's still a process. But I would say that if you talk to most people with the disease of addiction, they'll tell you that they feel that same way. There's just something missing.
And what made you finally seek treatment?
Well, I could see that my life was quickly coming apart. As I described it to Jeff, I had built a house of cards, lie upon lie, especially with my ex-wife, but everyone around me. And it was becoming more and more difficult to keep it together, keep those lies together. My relationship with my then-wife was crumbling, and I could see, I guess, so to speak, the writing on the wall. And so it was at that point that I started to take at first some half-hearted steps toward recovery, but eventually really dove fully into that pursuit.
Let's take a call from Joe in Monroeville at 412-246-2002. Joe, you are on with Jason Snyder and Jeffrey Benzing.
Good afternoon, guys. How are you guys today?
Good. How about you, Joe?
Not too bad. Hey, I also struggle with the disease and am in, you know, recovery. It's been over a year, and it's troubling to me what I see, the pandemic, and not only in our region, but across the country, and it's awful. And you know, I was able to conquer the addiction, and I did it with medicine and Bigfoot. And I think Jason knows, you know, what I'm talking there, recognize your voice. But what can we do? Like what can we do to try to curb this or you know, it's awful. It's destroying the youth of this country.
Well,
and you know, that's basically all I have to say. And I'll take, you know, my your guys' comments off there.
Well, Joe, thank you. And certainly we commend you for seeking help and hope that you're doing well and will continue to do well. You know, what about what Joe is saying? And it really seems to be a twofold problem, the problem of addiction. And also, Jeff, in your reporting for this series, you've discovered that there are barriers for people who decide, okay, I'm going to get help. And then as they're trying to obtain the recovery help that they need, there are barriers that go up. Tell us about them.
Well, for one thing, there is a gigantic lack of funding for drug treatment. The you know, very hardworking facilities around this region are always, you know, trying to make ends meet and trying to be able to give the fullest extent of help that they can. Meanwhile, insurance companies often, as Jason very explicitly saw, will only agree for a really, really short period of treatment, saying, you know, you're essentially, you know, you're in here 2 weeks, you're in here a month, you're good.
Why are the insurance companies deciding this? What, you know, are they deferring to the medical professionals? Are they getting advice from people in the medical field, from doctors?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are the insurance companies determining this?
Did the insurance company come see you when you were in?
Oh no, they never came to see me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, they certainly say that they're doing it, you know, giving the care that is required. But if you talk to any of the medical directors at any of the drug treatment facilities, they'll say they spend so much of their time fighting with insurance, saying, you know, we need this person in here for 3 months. We need him in here for 6 months, which is almost unheard of period of time. And there's also a huge unmet need, though. If everybody who needed drug treatment went into drug treatment, the facilities would just be totally overwhelmed, and they would have absolutely no money. I mean, it's just sort of alarming, the staggering gulf between what is actually being done and what needs to be done to address this problem. And it comes down a lot of times to money, but also to attention. You know, the issue of can I get help? Am I going to tear my life apart if I identify myself as someone who has a drug problem? You know, something that we all can do that doesn't cost any money is to, you know, look at people like Jason and say, you know, he has a very specific problem, but we all have tendencies that are, you know, we're not proud of. And this is really no different. It's how we deal with them, and to not ostracize and put them out as a pariah for having it be for a pill instead of a bottle of beer, or for, you know, gambling or whatever. There's so much that can be done just by sort of welcoming people in and being willing to look at them differently.
And Jason, I know that this will, you know, I'm from what I've read, from what Jeffrey and you have shared with us in this remarkable story, this is much like alcoholism. You never truly beat it. It's something you'll battle every day for the rest of your life. But to the extent that we can use the word recover, how were you able to recover, and what lessons can people take from what you've gone through from your experience?
Well, I think it was a process. I was willing to go into inpatient treatment despite all my denials. 12-step recovery has been a huge, huge difference in my life. It was at these meetings where I found individuals just like myself who were willing to do whatever they could to help me to get recovery, and it was at their insistence that I went to inpatient treatment. So I was willing to do that. Coming out of inpatient, though, as Jeff described it, I wasn't there as long as I would have liked. I was willing to go to outpatient treatment and did that for several months. And today I continue to stay connected to 12-step recovery. 4-5 meetings a week, I stay close to people who are in recovery, and I'm not afraid to ask them for help. You know, and I'm working on myself, right? It's, as I said, it's much more than the obsessive compulsive use of drugs. There's a big mental
component of this. It's perspective. It's a way of thinking about life. It's a way of looking at life. And it's by constantly improving on those things that I've been able to stay in recovery. And so those are the things that have worked well for me. I did want to quickly touch on, if I could, Paul, some of the things that Jeff mentioned as and answer Joe's questions about, you know, what are some of the other things that we can do. Certainly length of stay in inpatient treatment is a big issue. We need to address that length of stay. We also need to address the lack of inpatient beds in Western Pennsylvania. In my experience talking with folks who are trying to get into inpatient programs, they'll be put on wait lists. If you know anything about the disease of addiction, if you tell an injection an injection drug user, or any drug user for that matter, call me in 2 days, I'll see if I have a bed, forget about it. There are not enough inpatient beds. Third, I would say that there is not enough post-treatment recovery support and resources available. And so those are some of the things we need to address. Certainly, money is always an issue, no matter what we're dealing with. I do applaud Governor Wolf, who has increased the drug and alcohol program line item in his budget by $7 million. We have a governor and an administration in there with the political will to do something about this. The Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, Gary Tennis, is a true champion. So money is always going to be an issue. But when we look at reimbursement from commercial payers, we have to begin to ask, is that adequate? And the answer is no. Certainly public pay is nowhere near adequate. So when we ask treatment providers to innovate, they can't do it. They can't create new beds because they don't have the funding to do it. And you know as well as I do, if there was money to be made in drug and alcohol treatment, we would likely see treatment centers on just about every corner in every neighborhood of this county with either the letters UPMC or AHN on them, but we don't see that. So yes, there is an issue with funding, but I would not point specifically to government for that funding, but I would say in many cases what we're seeing from the commercial payers is inadequate as well to treat such a to treat a disease that is deeply affecting as it is.
Well, Jason Snyder, we certainly applaud your courage and appreciate your willingness to come in, share your story as you did with Jeffrey Benzing, who has also been with us as a guest. Jeffrey Benzing, a Public Source reporter. Jason Snyder also is executive director of the Consumer Health Coalition, and his story, Jason's story, was told in Jeff's article, which is out on Public Source, One Professional's Fight with Stigma, Denial, and Opioid Painkillers. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here to have this very important conversation on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Coming up, for the first time in over two decades, a team of American high school students has won the International Math Olympiad. We'll hear from the coach when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.